Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 69 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Oklahoma, where Brett Carver comes breeding on the plains. About my conversation with Oklahoma State University Regents Professor and Wheat Genetics Chair in Agriculture, Brett Carver, a 30-year veteran of the wheat breeding trenches. Carver is a genuinely nice guy, not to mention intelligent, articulate, and quick on his feet. We've met before, and I did a story on him for Wheat Life back in 2011 when he was leading the National Wheat Improvement Committee. My most recent encounter with him was in Scottsdale, Arizona in February, where we were both attending the Wheat Foods Council winter meeting. As those of you who stay abreast of Pacific Northwest wheat news know, the region's wheat and grain commissions have been working for more than 15 years to improve the quality of varieties released in Oregon, northern Idaho, and eastern Washington. One way we do this is through the rankings of our preferred variety brochure, which grades wheat varieties on their grain, milling, and baking properties, with most of the emphasis on milling and baking. Rankings include most desirable, desirable, acceptable, and least desirable. Another grade is unacceptable except customer-specific uses, which in my mind is just as bad as least desirable. You can access the PVB at the Washington Grain Commission website at wagrains.org, Farmers tab, and then Publications. Other regions of the country are getting involved in developing their own quality brochures, including Oklahoma, and from the Pacific Northwest's perspective, it's past time. But as Carver explains, there are different considerations at work on the Great Plains than there are in the Great Northwest, including having to consider those Oklahoma wheat farmers with cattle who graze their wheat for several months before it begins its reproductive stage. Quick refresher, there are six classes of wheat. Soft white wheat, which is predominantly grown in the Pacific Northwest, is the smallest class in terms of production. Hard red winter wheat, grown throughout the Great Plains, is the largest class. I opened my conversation with Carver by backgrounding him about the Northwest's Wheat and Grain Commission's emphasis on quality and asked him what the situation was in the hard red winter states generally and in Oklahoma specifically.
Well, I would have to say that too, we emphasize quality in the Great Plains. We being a wide assortment of breeding operations. But I have to qualify that statement by saying we emphasize to different degrees. And it really comes down to the intent and will of the breeder as far as how much emphasis is placed on quality. Right now, we're in a very competitive situation in our seed market. We have dwindling acres, but we have more breeding programs than we've ever had that I can remember. So there's less pie to go around, and there's a fierce competition. And one way to compete, surely this is the same way in the Pacific Northwest, but in the Great Plains, competition is expressed in variety trials. If you have a variety in that trial, wherever it is, and whoever is conducting it, usually it's a public program. Those are the ones that I think the ones that are being watched. If you want to compete, you have to do well in the yield column. So you know that's really the bottom line in terms of competition. It's not the bottom line in terms of us competing in a world market. A little bit a disconnect there. So what I'm seeing right now is a fierce competition at all costs. To improve yield, and if that means fudging a little bit on the quality side to win that yield, that might be an acceptable scenario.
Now that emphasis on yield is driven by corn and soybeans, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I don't think about corn and soybeans when I think about emphasis on yield because when it comes to winning acceptance for a wheat variety, the first filter that a producer is going to use to decide on that variety is going to be yielding ability, how well it fits that farmer's environment and locale. So I think that's inherent to wheat. It's inherent to a lot of grain crops, for that matter.
But when we're looking at profit per acre, I mean, the grower out in the Midwest is looking to see what's going to provide him the most revenue. And if he doesn't have wheat that yields well, he's going to be looking more at corn and soybeans, isn't he?
That's true. Although in some parts of the Great Plains, a corn and soybean option is not realistic. Maybe sorghum instead of corn. But as you get into the drier areas of the Great Plains, particularly southern areas, those options aren't really valid. So yeah, that is driving a little bit. But now, okay, we had this competition for yield, and we have a situation with quality where, you know, we have targets. Every class of wheat has a set of targets, and we all know what those targets are. But those targets should not be equated in our current environment with standards. Those are not our industry standards. We really had no industry standards. And if you don't have industry standards, then it's really up, again, to the intent and will of the breeder to interpret those targets. And those targets are not just specific points on a board. There's a lot of space there, what I call some wiggle room. And we exercise that wiggle room whenever we can. A good example of that, right now in the Great Plains, we've been hit pretty hard with a disease called wheat streak mosaic. And we've always had the Bartonella dwarf in terms of the viruses. We've always had wheat soil borne mosaic, wheat spindle streak. But now wheat streak is really moving in areas we haven't seen it before. And there's various reasons for that. We don't need to really go into that. But we had to contend with wheat streak. Well, we don't have a lot of good genetics for wheat streak. And so it would be very tempting, and I've seen it actually in very popular farmer publications where a breeding program will state, you know, we had this resistance to wheat streak. It's very effective. The quality is not quite up to standard, but we think it's very important to get this resistance out in the field. I don't think we've reached that kind of situation where it's all or nothing. You either have to have this variety with the resistance or you don't have any variety at all. I don't think we're there. But I think the situation is being used to the maximum to put and defend that variety that should not be out there, at least going through our grain handling system. But it can handle wheat streak. I can see other situations arise with other diseases, but that one comes to mind first.
Are you getting any pushback from millers and bakers about the quality of the varieties?
Well, you know, we get the normal pushback. That comes through primarily the point of contact would be the Wheat Quality Council, just like Pacific Northwest has. And that's a good environment to get feedback. But again, you know, this is not a situation where you prevent a variety from being commercialized. They're only passing on recommendations, and it's up to you as the breeder or maybe your institution that supports you. Your growers that support you to decide how far you're going to adhere to those recommendations. That kind of brings up another subject I think we probably need to talk about. And it's certainly pervasive in the Great Plains. I'm not sure about it in your area, but growers certainly have incentive to produce quality wheat. And, you know, if a farmer is producing hardy winter wheat, they're going to be paid for that. And I hear farmers say all the time, they're not paid for quality. Well, in a way, they are. You know, and if they're producing a hardy winter crop, that's what they're expected to deliver, and that's supposed to have certain characteristics associated with it. But then I think that being paid for quality or that incentive to produce quality actually runs over into the breeding programs. We have a situation where it takes effort to produce a high-yielding, good-quality variety. It takes effort to produce a high-yielding variety, for that matter. But then you want to throw quality on top of that. It's not that as if yield and, say, or protein content or protein quality are run in opposite directions. It's entirely possible to put those two characteristics together, but you have to apply the effort. Effort means data points. Effort means money. You know, and are you going to apply that effort? Well, you know, if I produce a variety that's just a dandy, a dandy for quality, and it's got that yield that will be competitive in variety trials. But yet that variety is going to be grown on the open market. It's going to go to the elevator. It's going to get blended in our grain handling system with other varieties that have inferior characteristics. Then all that effort really, goes down the bin, down the tube. And it's what I call the valley of the blend. You know, we start out at this higher level of quality in the breeding program, what we expect to be a good high-quality level. We put that genetics out in the open system, and that quality immediately goes down. You know, it gets blended. It may come back up, you know, depending on the kind of blend that occurs, but you never really recover the original quality that was intended and bestowed upon that variety. And that's a disincentive to the breeder. You know, knowing that quality will never be realized all the way through the system, you know, why spend that money? Why devote that effort?
But isn't the point that over a period of time, if you breed these quality varieties, that eventually they're going to be higher quality?
Exactly. That's a very good point. And I feel that so strongly now in my career. I didn't feel like I was in a very good position in terms of quality because I just didn't have much experience. I didn't have a lot of experience working with the germplasm. I had not accumulated good quality germplasm in the program, so what I was crossing with was not the best. Now, you know, over time, you whittle through your program, and you've a lot of our genetics in Oklahoma State University comes from, not just two varieties, but there are two that stand out, Duster and Billings. Those have very good in-use quality characteristics. Well, if that's the backbone of our germplasm, then I feel pretty comfortable moving forward. I'm going to have a pretty good quality variety coming out no matter what I produce. And that's not the feeling I had 20 years ago. But I'm not sure that all breeding programs can say that. I mean, this is 30 years of experience now that's accumulated that I didn't have, again, 20 years ago.
Wouldn't identity preservation...
Exactly. That was my next point. So we had to go to a different kind of system where we deliver the genetics all the way through the system and the grain handling system. And that, to me, is a way to resolve and re-incentivize the breeding programs. Not that, you know, everybody's just, you know, trashing out. I'm not saying that. But I think we can reach a higher standard. In fact, I think we can invoke our own standards.
How do you get companies to identity preserve? Because the bottom line is the more you identity preserve, the higher the cost.
I'm not suggesting identity preserve by a variety, but I think you can identity preserve with a group of varieties in a certain area of production. That's entirely possible. We're looking at that possibility in Oklahoma, and I'm sure other states are doing the same thing. I think that's a move in the right direction. We don't have to go to a single variety. I'm not sure the milling and baking industry really wants to rely on a single variety.
You might want to look at Washington. We established grain sheds, and we have a number of grain sheds that exporters can draw from specifically to get the kind of varieties they want. Have you got anything like that in Oklahoma?
Oh, certainly. I talked to Mark Hodges with Oklahoma Genetics, and he knows all about the grain sheds and knows how those grain sheds are being used by buyers inside and outside the country. But even within those grain sheds, you have a tremendous amount of genetic diversity feeding those sheds. I wouldn't say there's any one shed in Oklahoma that has year in and year out superior quality over the other. I mean, there may be a tendency, but I think we can stretch that much further as long as we concentrate genetics in a certain area that has that good foundation for quality and we keep it preserved throughout that grain handling. It's entirely possible. We just need to do it. We have to have that pull through the system, too. We can't just push it. I can't just say, well, we're going to produce these varieties in this area. We're going to have it over here in this set of elevators. Somebody has to come in and buy it.
Now, environment is 50% of the quality of any wheat variety, and in Washington, for instance, all of the country elevators have protein analyzers, and before farmers can dump, their protein is gauged. Is there anything like that in the Oklahoma?
I really cannot and should not comment on that. I think we need to be more like that if we aren't. But I also realize that protein content by itself is just not a very good indicator. I wouldn't want to be locked in on a certain high level of protein. We can produce a very good quality protein at 11.5 to 12%. Not that I'm going to target 11.5%, but we can come up with that. And as long as I have that opportunity, I will do it. Now below 11.5, that's another area. Mm-hmm. We're not going to go there. At least in terms of variety releasing.
Now, are you driven at all by what the export customers want? Because certainly in Washington, that's our driver.
Yeah, and I've had those driving signals through U.S. Wheat, having visited many of those countries and heard their messages, and there's some continuity in those messages. One being, let's see more consistency in the product coming out. I think just our breeding program alone, I think we're getting more consistent. So I feel like that's a very reachable goal. But yeah, I get those signals. I know what we need to breed for, and know how to do it. I had the germplasm in place to do it. I just want to see the grower accept it and be rewarded for it, for taking that extra effort.
Well, and we have that same conundrum in Washington because the grower is paid for yield, but we also talk about a market share. And, you know, the grower is growing for that market share, but he's being paid for yield. So it gets a bit complicated.
Yeah, it does. It does. And the industry needs to come together as a whole. And I'm not sure that our industry operates in total equilibrium at the moment. Industry being, you know, all the way from breeding program through extension, through research, through our handling system, to the end users. You know, I think a good example of some of the disequilibrium that I'm seeing, there's nothing malicious about it, but we can improve this, is through our national yield contest. You know, we have a yield contest it's important yield, but it emphasizes it, overemphasizes it in my estimate. But we need to consider the fact that wheat is a food crop. It is consumed as a food crop. Yeah, corn and soybeans are too, but it's a little bit different with wheat. You're just consuming the whole grain. Now, corn, yeah, I guess we eat some popcorn, or eat corn on the cob and edamame with soybeans, but wheat's a whole different animal.
But wheat has also gone from 57 million acres in 2000 to 37 million acres in 2017. And once again, I'm going to bring up the corn and soybean aspect of it because these farmers need to have the yield in order to compete with corn and soybeans, at least in certain areas where they have the moisture. And I understand the quality contest, and certainly in Washington, we really have emphasized a quality component. Once again, it gets very complicated.
It does. Of course, you have to throw price in there. And I'm not real familiar with what determines price, but I know price is not very good right now. I think we can be yield competitive. I know we can be with soybeans. I think we're on the same plane. But, you know, the price has to be also commensurate with that. But we could, you know, a rain-fed potential yield in the southern Great Plains of 100 bushels per acre, that's not off the chart. It's very reachable, unless we have a substantial drought, which we are headed for this year, by the way. But you know, other than that, yeah, that's a very reachable goal, and that's a competitive yield.
But there has to be some changes with regard to what farmers plant. And in Washington, for instance, farmers haven't been able to save seed for replanting our newest releases for at least 5 years. Our certified seed use exceeds 90%. Can Oklahoma farmers save seed, and what's your certified seed use now, and do you see that changing?
Well, certainly not at the level that Washington is at in certified seed use, but certified seed use has increased dramatically, particularly as wheat varieties have become protected. You know, plant breeding rights are now being exercised on just about any variety coming out of a public or private program. So I think the numbers are somewhere in the 20 to 30% certified seed usage. We'd like to see that number a little bit higher than that, of course. But there's also that option to save seed, and I wouldn't argue against that option, particularly in areas where, you know, if a farmer is going to be planting a wheat crop, not knowing if that crop's even going to be harvested for grain, much less seed. that option exists.
And explain to the listeners how Oklahoma farmers graze their wheat and then decide whether it's going to go to harvest or not.
Right, and just right off the top, any given year, it's about one half of our acreage could be used for the purpose of grazing and grain production, dual purpose. Now, another small sliver might be used for just total graze out, never you know, go to the bin. But that option exists in Texas, Oklahoma, parts of Kansas, parts of Colorado, to plant the crop early. We're talking about 6 weeks earlier to generate the pasture necessary to turn out cattle around Thanksgiving, which would be in Oklahoma, and graze that pasture, utilize the wheat species as it exists as a grass, and then pull the cattle off and before reproductive development commences, what we call the appearance of the hollow stem, first hollow stem date, which is going to be somewhere in late February, early March. That's a good period of grazing where additional income can be gained. Now, as far as the decision on, you know, do you even start that crop early for that opportunity to have grazing? Do you pull the cattle off in March or do you continue on with the grazing? Those decisions are made based on dollars. You know, what is the best potential gain off this crop? Is it going to be through beef gains off the cattle or is it going to be through grain? And those are pretty complicated decisions. I'm glad I'm not the one having to make those.
And do you breed wheat with that in mind, with grazing in mind?
Most certainly, because it's a different adaptation system to breed for. And so we incorporate actual breeding. Actual grazing into the breeding system at certain points of the breeding program. It's not year in and year out. It's not throughout the entire 10 to 12-year breeding cycle. But at certain key points, we breed for, by using grazing animals, improved grazing tolerance. And, you know, that may not, it probably wouldn't impact quality, but it certainly impacts the ability of that crop to reproduce and therefore have a good grain yield.
Sometimes I forget that the Pacific Northwest does not comprise the wheat-growing universe and is, in fact, only a small part of it. That realization always makes me eager to learn about the challenges and solutions from those outside our region. Carver may be preaching to the choir, but when it's a choir in an entirely different zip code, it's important for us to listen and learn. Hope you enjoyed episode 69, or what I entitled, Oklahoma, where Brett Carver comes breeding on the plain. Please join me again next time for another episode of Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in its head. Through a history of starvation in times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.